All right. Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for continuing to stick around so late in the afternoon. So what I want to talk about today is these physician concerns regarding Catholic hospital OB-GYN care. Specifically, I want to discuss a study that we undertook that's a qualitative study based on interviews with OB-GYNs who are working in Catholic facilities to see when they've come into conflict with their hospital over ethical guidelines. I have no disclosures to make as well. So just a brief overview, we're going to start with a little bit of background on the state of Catholic hospitals in America today, a little bit about our qualitative interview methods, and then some results. And in my case, it's going to be a qualitative study, so it's going to be a little more like story time than data time. And then we'll go over a few of the public health implications that I think are relevant for this conference. So often when we talk about ethical issues surrounding medical care, we think about conflicts between the provider and the patient. So a physician believes that abortions are morally wrong and refuses to provide abortions for patients who request them. That's something that comes up a lot. But what our research focused on more was a conflict between the institution, the healthcare providing institution, and the provider and patient who are kind of on the same team. So for example, a patient requests a termination of their pregnancy. The physician agrees that that's medically indicated, but the Catholic institution perhaps where they work decides that that's not something that they can ethically support. And before I go any further, I just want to point out that the vast majority of the time, Catholic hospitals provide excellent medical care to their patients, really in line with what the patient's needs are, and they have a very admirable goal of care for the underserved. But there are some situations in which these ethical guidelines and religious objectives can kind of get in the way of what we usually see as the standard of care, and that's what we're going to be addressing today. So this is not a small problem. 4 out of the largest 10 hospital systems in the United States are Catholic hospital systems, and that accounts for 1 out of every 6 hospital admissions, even higher in some other states. So if you're a young woman seeking care for your reproductive needs, there's a reasonably high chance that you'll be going to a Catholic institution, and some of these issues could come up. So Catholic hospitals have a set of guidelines, and they're called the Ethical and Religious Directives, and I'll be referring to them as the ERDs. And throughout this presentation, I'm going to put up a few of the directives so that you can see the kind of language that's used in these guidelines and how it can be interpreted. So this is Directive 5 that basically just states that you're supposed to follow the directives if you're a Catholic hospital. Of course, there's variation in enforcement from hospital to hospital. Some hospitals are very strict, and yes, we will follow the ERDs, and we will do what the bishops tell us to do. Other hospitals have a lot more wiggle room, a lot more workarounds are possible. And generally, if a physician feels like a patient really needs a procedure that's banned by the ERDs, they can usually take it before the ethics committee and argue that point. They may or may not be successful in getting that, in getting permission to provide that procedure for their patient. So our current study came out of a couple studies that my co-collaborators, Dr. Friedman and Dr. Stolberg, had done previously. Dr. Stolberg did a more quantitative study that looked at OB-GYNs who had worked in Catholic hospital settings, and she found that over half of those physicians had come into some sort of moral or ethical conflict with their institution over their provision of care. Dr. Friedman similarly had done a more qualitative study in which she interviewed OB-GYNs who worked at Catholic institutions and found that there was a pretty high incidence in her interviews of conflict with the institution over miscarriage management, which is not usually something we think of as a situation where tension could come up with a Catholic hospital. So that was really interesting to us, and we wanted to investigate that a little more. So the kind of main questions we wanted to explore through our qualitative interviews were, how often do these conflicts come up, and what's the nature of the conflicts? What kind of procedures or medical treatments tend to be most contentious in Catholic hospital settings? And how often do these actually impact healthcare outcomes? So how often can physicians get workarounds, or how often can the patient get care at another facility without it negatively impacting their health? So we drew our study sample from Dr. Stolberg's original study that I just previously mentioned, of the physicians who said that they would be willing to have further interviews. Then we further had a snowball sampling method to find other physicians who would be willing to talk to us about these issues. We ended up having 31 in-depth interviews with physicians across the country, 27 of whom had had substantial experience at Catholic institutions in their training or in their career. We used a grounded theoretical analysis to come up with some key themes, and those are kind of what I'm going to be presenting to you today. So our physician population that we interviewed was a pretty diverse population. These physicians are practicing all across the United States, and they have really diverse religious backgrounds as well. So some of these physicians have no religious beliefs whatsoever, and some are very passionately religious, even in the Catholic Church. And so we thought that provided a good representation of different physician backgrounds. And we came up with a lot of different themes that we thought were significant, but I think there are two that are really important to discuss in this public health context today. One is the risk of harm to women from these Catholic ERDs, and the other is the disproportionate impact that they can have on low-income women. And there are many different medical concerns where these issues can come up, but the two that I really want to point out to you today are the context of sterilization or tubal ligation procedures and miscarriage management. I think those are the ones that give us the best picture of how these can play out in women's day-to-day lives. So here's another excerpt from the ERDs that basically just tells us that, as many of us know, birth control is not something that the Catholic Church condones. Furthermore, sterilization is not something that the Catholic Church condones, except for in situations where procedures that induce sterility are permitted when their direct effect is the cure or alleviation of a present and serious pathology. So essentially, if it's absolutely necessary for a woman's health care, this allowances can be made, and it's going to depend from hospital to hospital. That being said, sterilization is a really common procedure across the United States. It's the second most common form of contraception in use today after birth control pills, so this is a really common situation. And there are some situations in which sterilization in the hospital setting is pretty important. So often women will request sterilization postpartum because this eliminates the need for a second procedure. So specifically, if a woman's going in for a C-section, say, and she's scheduled for that C-section, she's already open, she's already having a surgery, and it's really nice to be able to just perform the tubal ligation at that time rather than having to have a second surgery down the line and a second set of surgical complication risks. Furthermore, we know that delaying sterilization can really increase the risk of unplanned pregnancy. So there's this excellent study that came out of the University of Texas at San Antonio that said that of all the women that they followed, who had requested a tubal ligation, approximately 31% were unable to get that tubal for one reason or another. Of that 31% who couldn't get their tubal ligation, nearly half had an unplanned pregnancy in the next year. So that's a pretty significant increase in unplanned pregnancies from delaying these tubal ligations when the woman could really be having them immediately postpartum. So that being said, I want to kind of read to you from what some of our physicians had to say. So this is the story time part. I'm going to start by kind of giving you an overview of the situation the physician was in, and then I'll read to you what they had to say to us. So the physician in the story is Dr. A, and Dr. A works in a town where the sole community hospital is Catholic. She didn't work for the Catholic hospital. She works for a non-religious clinic outside of town, but she does have admitting privileges and delivery privileges at the Catholic hospital. She knows that in the Catholic hospital, it's not okay to perform a tubal ligation, and most of the time that's fine. However, when the patient is having a C-section, she really wanted to be able to perform the tubal ligation at the same time, if that it was the patient's request. So Dr. A and her colleagues came to an agreement with the Catholic hospital, where the hospital actually sold one of their operating rooms to the clinic. And in that operating room, they were able to have staff from the clinic and equipment from the clinic to perform the procedure. And that meant from beginning to end, so from the delivery in the cesarean section to the end of the tubal ligation, none of the hospital equipment could be used. So it was a pretty strict policy, but it worked pretty well for them. The only problem was that staffing the OR could be really tricky at night. So they had a voluntary clinic staff schedule, and it didn't cover every night. So it was kind of a Russian roulette situation for patients who came in and needed a C-section. So the problem arose when this patient named Amy came in one day. We'll call her Amy. So she came in to deliver her third child, and Amy had a lot of very serious medical problems. She was also a pretty low-income woman. She had no reason to believe that she was going to need a C-section that night, but she had signed a consent for a tubal ligation. She really wanted a tubal ligation, and just in case she needed a C-section, she signed this consent months in advance. So she came in, and her labor began to stall. And Dr. B, who was on call that night, tells us the story of when he made the decision that he thought the C-section was going to be necessary. Dr. B says, she goes, "So I signed the papers, so I'm all set." And I thought to myself, oh no, I didn't even know at that point if I had a team covering that night. And when I went to look at the calendar, I saw there was no team signed up to come in. So I went back to the room and I told her, I said, you know, I can't do your tubal ligation. And she's like, what are you talking about? My abdomen's gonna be wide open, right? I said, yes. She said, well, isn't it right there? I mean, isn't it all just right there? Isn't it, like, kind of easy at that point? And I said, well, yeah. She goes, so why can't you? And I said, well, I can't because, you know, the hospital has certain rules, and I can't bypass those rules. She kept looking at me like, what are you talking about? I said, well, are you aware of the restrictions placed on birth control by the Catholic Church? She goes, well, I'm not Catholic. And that's when I heard the expletives of, you've got to be blanking kidding me. This is my health, and you're going to open me up now, and I'm going to have to go through another procedure? Look at me. I can't go through another procedure. And I couldn't have agreed with her more, and I told her that. And she finally looked at me and said, would you do it anyway? She broke my heart. Had I done that, the contract that exists between the hospital and the clinic to allow tubal ligations to happen would most likely be instantly dissolved. So that means any other woman going forward who's planning her C-section and tubal ligation tomorrow or next week or next month, they'd all lose that. So Dr. B didn't perform the tubal ligation that night. And we actually had a follow-up interview with Dr. A, who told us that Amy became pregnant again 3 months postpartum. The next pregnancy was medically complicated, and she was admitted to the hospital 8 times. Preterm labor happened at 32 weeks, and she went into an adequately staffed with non-hospital staff members OR. She got her C-section, and she got a tubal ligation at that time, but the baby was in the NICU for 5 weeks. That is a complication that could have been avoided. So that's one example of where these situations can kind of play out with real-world healthcare implications outside of just elective abortion procedures, right? The other kinds of situations that I want to talk about today are miscarriage management situations. So we think about elective abortions when we think about Catholic healthcare, but a lot of times pregnancy terminations can kind of come into miscarriage management. So obviously the ethical and religious directives specifically state that abortions are not permitted, but that pregnancy terminations can, in some certain situations, similar to the sterilizations, be permitted if it's absolutely necessary for the health of the woman. So miscarriage is a pretty common situation. It occurs in 10 to 15% of pregnancies. And in some situations, patients can prevent with what we call an inevitable miscarriage. So they have not yet miscarried. The fetus is still has a heartbeat, but we know that the miscarriage is going to happen. Maybe they've broken their bag of water, the cervix is dilated, and it's inevitable. But this can be a pretty prolonged process, and miscarriages can be pretty uncomfortable, both physically and emotionally. So the standard of care is to be able to offer some sort of treatment to women in these situations. Maybe they can be offered medical treatment, maybe they can be offered surgical treatment, or maybe they can be allowed to just let it progress naturally and have a watchful waiting experience. But the standard of care is generally to provide those options. That's not always possible in Catholic healthcare situations. So I have another story for you. So this is with Dr. C, who worked at a non-Catholic hospital, where the other hospital in town was a Catholic institution. Dr. C says, it was a young girl, a teenager, and she's gone to the local Catholic hospital. I think she was 14 or 15 weeks. And they told her that she was dilated and the baby still had a heartbeat. I think she'd gone to see them initially because she was bleeding. And they told her that they couldn't do anything for her to get in the car and to drive to my non-Catholic hospital. And she comes into triage, and the nurse pages me overhead immediately, which is not something that happens very often. So I come running in, and the fetus is partway out. The feet were already in the vagina, and I just delivered the rest of the pregnancy. It was not an ideal situation for the patient. You know, our triage is not really the place that you want to be delivering. So, bad images for all of us. But I think, again, an important illustration of how these things can kind of go south. The last thing that I really want to illustrate for you all is that, yes, these medical complications can happen, but we think that in some situations they can have a disproportionate impact on low-income women who maybe have less of a choice in where to receive their care. So patients whose insurance only covers the local Catholic hospital often can't receive a tubal sterilization at all. Dr. G described to us how insurance-related workarounds often aren't possible for these low-income patients. Dr. G states that, when they first stopped doing tubal ligations at my Catholic hospital, I thought it was terrible because our hospital is the main maternity hospital and our patients tend to be the lower socioeconomic patients. So you had a situation where if you had insurance, you had a job, or you had money, you could go across the street and get your tubal done. But if you were getting Medicaid, then you didn't have access to that. And I thought it was a terrible double standard. Again, we have another situation with a doctor named Dr. E, who worked in a non-Catholic hospital. And he pointed out the plight of patients similar to Amy from our first story, who've requested in advance that their OBGYN perform a tubal ligation if they end up delivering by C-section. But these low-income patients may not have access to reliable transportation. So when you go into labor, sometimes you call the ambulance, and the ambulance takes you to the closest hospital. That closest hospital may be a Catholic institution, and there your wishes may not be respected. Dr. E told us that his patients tell him, look, my prenatal care was at a non-Catholic institution, but I ended up in a Catholic institution because I was in labor and I called the ambulance and the ambulance guy brought me to the nearest place. So his patients end up getting a C-section at these Catholic institutions and then have to wait for a separate tubal months later. And again, that increases the risk of surgical complications because you need to have two procedures, and often women don't actually end up getting the tubal ligation that they desired. So these are situations in which, due to a lack of transportation, low-income patients are unable to make their desired contraceptive choices and lose that agency. So those were a few vignettes that I think kind of like illustrate the spectrum of issues that you can face. And here are some of the public health implications that we found. So you may get increased poor health outcomes in these women who are receiving care at Catholic institutions. And we may also see an increase in existing reproductive health disparities between low-income and high-income women due to receiving care in Catholic hospital settings. So we'd like to thank all of our funders and co-collaborators, and I'd like to thank you very much for listening today.